We're going to decide if we are a nation of the people of the lie or people of the light.
Well, I vote for light, but I live in California, so my vote may not count.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Well, we'll see.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains, KKRN, where all of our votes count. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's Queso, and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, and Rochester, New York's WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet, so the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com as we go to air on Election Day 2024. Thank Woo-hoo. You very much for joining us today. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
You're woo-hooing. You must be in a good mood for some reason today.
No, I'm just trying to hang in there.
Okay, well, keep hanging.
Yep.
60-year-old Democratic Vice President Kamala Harris, if she is ultimately certified as the winner of the 2024 presidential election, well, she would be the first woman, the first black woman, and the first person of South Asian descent to serve as president of the United States. She would also be the first sitting vice president to win the White House in 36 years.
Wow.
Her opponent, the 70-year-old former President Donald Trump, who is a 34-time convicted felon, but was allowed to vote, by the way, on Tuesday to cast his ballot in Florida, where most convicts are actually barred from voting. He was allowed largely due to the technicality, essentially, of him not having been sentenced in that case yet. So he was allowed to vote down in Palm Beach on Tuesday.
And that is the first time anybody in the history of the United States has ever had to make that kind of explanation.
Correct. He would be the oldest president ever elected, and ultimately, if he was determined to be the winner, the first person convicted of a felony, much less 34 of them, first one to take the Oval Office. He would also be the first defeated president in 132 years to win another term in the White House. So for the record, since we're going to hit a number of historical points on today's broadcast, if time allows, the last defeated president to later go on to win the presidency after having left the White House was Grover Cleveland. He served as the 22nd president from 1885 to 1889. He lost the 1888 election to Benjamin Harrison, but then came back to win the 1892 election, becoming the 24th president as well as the 22nd, 132 years ago. Donald Trump is hoping to pull that feat off again. A victory for him, explaining why he is so desperate to win the presidency at any cost, even if he has to steal it in the event that Harris is unofficially named the winner of the Electoral College this week, would all but assure, if he wins, it would all but assure he avoids going to prison, at least over the next 4 years, after having been found guilty for his role in hiding hush money payments to an adult film actress to help him cheat to win his first term as president back in 2016. His sentencing in the hush money case, depending on how things unfold in the days and weeks ahead, could occur later this month. And upon taking office, Trump could simply order his Department of Justice to end at least the federal investigations into his effort to steal the 2020 election results and his theft of thousands of pages of highly classified national security documents upon leaving office in 2021. So, yeah, the stakes are very high for Donald Trump today, but I would argue much higher for the rest of us in both this country and, frankly, around the world, where the future of humanity itself is at stake thanks to man-made climate change. That was also on Tuesday's ballot, as Desi Doyen will remind us yet again in our latest Green News report later this hour.
Oh, yes.
Of course, going into Tuesday, we have been told by virtually all of the corporate media outlets that the race is essentially tied, both nationally and in particular in the seven or so battleground states that will likely determine the winner of the Electoral College this year, based on pre-election polling that may or may not prove to have been accurate. We shall see. And in fact, those of you listening to this broadcast on Wednesday, as a number of our affiliate stations run us the next morning, you all probably know by now whether those pre-election polls predicting a tie just about everywhere were actually accurate or not, if the race, you know, turns out to be as close as predicted, or whether many of those polling outlets were sort of pulling their punches by overestimating support for Donald Trump, as a number of folks have been suggesting in the run-up to Election Day. Well, in any event, we should all have a somewhat clearer picture of that by Wednesday, even as, I will remind you, it took 4 days, essentially until Saturday after the election back in 2020, before media outlets finally declared the unofficial winner to be Joe Biden in the presidential race. So it could take a while. And so with that in mind, as you probably know, every 4 years, the media have the quaint tradition of turning to the teeny tiny township of Dixville Notch, New Hampshire, the first in the nation to vote on Election Day every 4 years, beginning immediately after midnight on Monday night or Tuesday morning, to see if there is any knowledge that might be gleaned from the handful of voters who still live and cast their votes there. The media love it. But what's not to love? They all gather at midnight as they become the first poll to open in the United States on Election Day. They all cast hand-marked paper ballots, which after everyone in the town, usually less than a dozen official residents, cast their votes, well, the ballot box is opened up and hand-counted in front of everyone, including in front of the media, etc., in what is actually the best example of what democracy should look like across the country, in my opinion.
Public oversight.
In the recent past, voters there have supported the Democratic nominee, at least in the last two presidential elections. Back in 2016, Hillary Clinton won 4 of 7 votes in the township that year. 2 votes went to Trump, 1 to the Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson at the time. In 2020, voters in Dixville Notch unanimously cast all 5 votes that year for Joe Biden. In January of this year, 4 registered Republican voters and 2 independent voters participated in the GOP primary, casting 6 unanimous ballots for former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. So, of course, as the first in the nation, the media was there on Monday night, Tuesday morning, to see what, if anything, could be gleaned about this year's elections. Even though, to my knowledge, the vote in Dixville Notch has never actually turned out to be particularly predictive of the actual presidential results.
True.
Nonetheless, as starving as we all are for any indication of how things might go this year, as Tuesday rolled in, it turns out that Dixville Notch, just after midnight, may or may not have turned out to be helpful to us today. As CNN reports, Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump tied tied with three votes each in the tiny New Hampshire township of Dixville Notch, kicking off Election Day, one of the first places in the country to report its preference. So, yeah, that's not helpful. The unincorporated township is located along the U.S.-Canada border in New Hampshire's northern tip. It opened and closed its polls just after midnight in a tradition that dates back to 1960. But a tie, Dixville Notch? We could have had the polling averages tell us that. But actually, the results from Dixville could be helpful, more helpful than they first appear. Though the six voters split 3-3 between Harris and Trump, the electorate was apparently made up of four Republicans and two undeclared voters. So, yeah, at least one of the Republicans voted for the Democrat, Kamala Harris, and who knows, perhaps three of them did. So take that for what it's worth, which is not much. But we will take what we can until polls officially close across the country as of Tuesday evening. In some cases, later than planned due to voting problems, voting system problems, I should say. The voters were fine. The systems had a few problems, but not too many. We'll get to that in a bit. So can we learn any more from, if we can't learn from Dixville Notch, can we learn any more from the poll aggregator sites that actually use the pre-election polling to come up with an official forecast for who is most likely to win the race? Well, for that, we turn today to Nate Silver, the founder of 538.com and really sort of the inventor of these poll aggregation forecast sites, who he now runs his own site called the Silver Bulletin, where they run tens of thousands of simulations of an election each day throughout the pre-election period based on the pre-election polling data as it comes in, historical data, the economy, early vote data, other factors that are written into their algorithm to try and predict what will actually happen on Election Day. And today, of course, they ran their final simulation for the 2024 presidential race. As Silver reported on Tuesday, quote, "When I say the odds in this year's presidential race are about as close as you can possibly get to 50-50, I'm not exaggerating." He says that at exactly midnight on Tuesday, I pressed the go button for the final time on our election model this year. I knew it was going to be close. I felt like I was spinning a roulette wheel. Perhaps more like a Russian roulette wheel, but I digress. Back to Silver, he says, "We decided ahead of time to run 80,000 simulations instead of our usual 40,000. And after 80,000 election simulations, Kamala Harris won the Electoral College in 40,012 of them. That would equate to 50.015%.
Wow.
So they ran 80,000 times. She won 40,012 of them. The remaining were split between Trump, who got 39,718, and the rest were no majority. 269-269 Electoral College tie, which he notes, practically speaking, would probably be resolved for Donald Trump in his favor in the U.S. House if that were to actually happen. It gets thrown to the U.S. House to decide. Republicans there, even if they lose the majority after Tuesday, they're still likely to hold a majority of House delegations, where each state gets exactly one vote to settle such a tie and determine who would be the next president in such a case. Let's hope that one doesn't happen. So anyway, yeah, not particularly helpful either. So maybe we're just going to have to wait for, you know, the actual voters and their votes to be, you know, actually counted
what?
And canvassed and certified before we will know who the winner is.
You mean carefully count and make sure it's accurate and all of that? What?
Or, of course, if you're listening on Wednesday, you may know whether or not one of these people have already been named by the media in the event that all of these pre-election polls were actually pulling their punches and unwilling to stick their necks out with what their polls were actually finding, We'll see. Or if all of those models were just, you know, for example, overcompensating for in Donald Trump's favor after they had actually underestimated his support over the past two presidential elections. All the pollsters really made adjustments for that. And some people are wondering if perhaps they overcorrected this year. We will find out that soon enough, though we're going to have to, you know, wait for the votes to be counted, at least by computers, to find out if that is the case.
Yeah, and I just want to underscore that the media, any media outlet calling the election for one person or the other, that's not official. That is not binding.
That's right.
It's important to keep that in mind. It's not official.
As I'm happy to say, the election day, at least as we go to air, has run mostly smoothly. However, there have been some isolated reports of actually sort of normal at this point election day problems that, yes, do happen, including long lines in some places, some technical issues with voting systems and ballot printing devices. But nothing yet of enormous note has been reported, even as I always warn that such problems do not always come to light immediately, either on election day or during tabulation in the days that follow. But there were some problems in some swing state counties. So, some counties in swing states and battleground states. So if those states turn out to be as close as everyone is predicting, then, those problems in some of those counties could become a real problem during the post-election period. In Pennsylvania, for example, which I expect to be the tipping point state this year, early reports that Republican poll watchers were not allowed into some polling sites, those were soon resolved, as PBS reports it this afternoon. But a Pennsylvania state judge in Cambria County ordered polls to remain open for an extra 2 hours on Tuesday night. Normally it'll close at 8 p.m. local time. It'll close at 10. Those polls will close at 10 p.m. on Tuesday in Cambria. That's a town that voted 68% for Donald Trump back in 2020. The county had sought an extension after what appeared to be a software malfunction affected the ability to scan hand-marked ballots. Turns out it's the ballots themselves that were printed incorrectly, so they couldn't be scanned correctly by the scanner. They have since replaced them with ballots that apparently scan properly, and all of the ballots that were voted on that couldn't be scanned were put into a secure lockbox to be scanned later. A technical malfunction in Champaign County, Illinois, and challenges with e-poll books in Louisville, Kentucky, in a very Democratic area, that also delayed voting for some. Those issues were reportedly fixed before too long. In Arizona's critical Maricopa County, which includes Phoenix, one of the voting locations was slightly delayed because a worker forgot to bring a key, which, yes, does happen from time to time.
Oh dear.
In a Democratic-leaning Native American county in Arizona, there were problems with the on-demand printers that held up voting for hours. Those polls may remain a bit open a bit longer than usual. In Missouri, flooding made one St. Louis area poll site hard to reach, knocked out power to another, requiring poll workers to turn to a generator to continue election operations. But still, PBS reports that in various states affected by rain, and there were a few of them, voters were enthusiastically huddling under umbrellas as they lined up to cast their ballots. Quote, "We'll be like post office workers in rain or snow or sleet," said voter Mary Ruskowski after she cast her ballot in windy Racine, Wisconsin, wiping raindrops off her face. You go, girl. In Georgia, Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, my good friend, said there were some reported bomb threats to polling places, but that all were deemed to be non-credible threats and originating from accounts, email accounts, said to be tied to Russia, who Raffensperger said are not our friends, and anyone who says otherwise doesn't know what they're talking about and what could be seen as a shot toward Vladimir Putin, pal, and Republican nominee Donald Trump. In Maine, at least three high schools that served as polling places were subject to false reports of shooters. The polls remained open, and according to the Maine Secretary of State, voting continued uninterrupted as police confirmed that the calls were hoaxes. But as I said, we will continue to keep our eyes on actual problems of note at both the polls and during tabulation in the days ahead. As we always tell you, sometimes it takes a while before problems like that come to life, problems that have a real effect on results. Helping voting run relatively smoothly on election day is the fact that tens of millions of Americans had already cast their ballots during early voting, including record numbers in Georgia, North Carolina, other battleground states that could determine the winner. Thus, there is just a lot less pressure on election day precincts to accommodate enormous numbers of voters. Early voting is helping a lot in that regard. And it also makes problems when they do occur a lot easier to deal with and the lines a lot less long, etc. The absence of any significant widespread problems, however, has not stopped Donald Trump or the RNC, which is now controlled by Trump, from making numerous claims of fraud, both during the early voting period and on Election Day, likely a prelude to challenges after Election Day. But while there have been no major reports of any malicious cyber activity affecting election offices so far, foreign actors have been active in using fake social media profiles and websites to drum up partisan vitriol and disinformation. In the final weeks, U.S. Intelligence officials have attributed to Russia multiple fake videos alleging election fraud in presidential swing states. On the eve of Election Day, they issued a joint statement, the intelligence communities, along with federal law enforcement agencies, warning that Russia in particular was ramping up its influence operations, including in ways that could incite violence and likely would continue those efforts well after the votes have been cast. So far, however, as we go to air, I'm happy to say voting has, by and large, been peaceful so far. Beyond that, at the moment, my friend and longtime election integrity colleague, Richard Hayes Phillips, an election data researcher and expert and author of the book Witness to a Crime, A Citizen's Audit of an American Election, which he wrote following the contested 2004 presidential election in Ohio. He and I have been touching base as he laid out a few points out of battleground states today that may help us set some expectations for the next few days when it comes to vote counting in each of those states, if in fact all of this turns out to be as close as people have been warning us. So Hayes Phillips tells me to once again expect the likelihood of a so-called red mirage in at least four battleground states on election night. Now, for those who don't remember or are unfamiliar with the term, red mirage is when the initial vote tallies come in and they look very good for Republicans, in this case for Donald Trump, because the type of votes that are being counted weigh heavily toward Republicans, only to see that change when all the votes come in, particularly votes that weigh more heavily in favor of Democrats. Now, in 2020, you'll recall in the middle of the pandemic, Democrats were largely voting early or by mail to help avoid catching COVID at a crowded polling place. Donald Trump, on the other hand, was lying to his supporters about COVID and about the elections and claiming that mail voting was somehow fraudulent and so that they should cast their votes on Election Day. They should risk their lives to do that. His hope at the time, back in 2020, was that the first votes to be counted would be Election Day votes, which would lean heavily Republican, so he could declare victory on election night before the more heavily Democratic absentee ballots could be processed and added in. They take longer to process. And of course, that's what he famously did. And he's expected to try to do that again this year on election night, claim victory with this red mirage helping him. But it's different in each state, depending on whether they count their absentee ballots, which are still leaning more Democratic, though not as much as 2020, if they count their absentee ballots before Election Day, or if they aren't processed until, they can't start processing until Election Day. So more heavily Republican votes that are cast at the polls on Election Day, those votes are counted and reported out first. It's different in every state. There also are many other factors, like states that allow late absentee votes that are postmarked before Election Day, but they may not arrive until after Election Day, and so forth. But for now, Richard Hayes Phillips helpfully broke down the basics for me this way, explaining where we might expect to see a so-called red mirage on Tuesday night before more heavily Democratic votes are added into the total. It's not a crime. None of this is a crime. None of it is an indication of fraud, as Trump and Republicans will likely lie to you about it. It's just the way that votes are counted in the various states, since each state does it a little bit differently.
Yeah, and it's basically Trump and Republicans are trying to prey upon people's lack of understanding about administrative procedures for elections.
So we will help you to understand so that you will not be their prey. So the best possibilities for what Richard sees as potential red mirage states in four battlegrounds based on early and absentee vote numbers tracked before Election Day. He says that in Arizona, early votes are reported first, in a state where he says that 190,000 more Republicans than Democrats voted early. So you would have a red mirage there, as those heavily Republican votes that were cast early are counted first. Also, similar in Nevada, early votes also reported first there, he tells me, and that there were 40,000 more Republicans than Democrats who voted early. So early results could falsely indicate Republican victories in both Arizona and Nevada initially on Tuesday night, but don't be fooled. It may just be a mirage. And it's sort of a reverse situation in two of the three so-called blue wall states. That would be Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, where if Harris wins in all three of those states, she will almost certainly win the White House. So Pennsylvania, their early votes are generally reported last. They're not even allowed to begin opening absentee ballot envelopes in Pennsylvania until Election Day morning. And yet there are more than 400,000 more Democratic early votes than Republicans, says Richard. So he says we might, you know, see a red mirage there as well as of Tuesday night, only to then see Pennsylvania go heavily to the Democrats once absentee ballots are finally added into the results. The same is also true in Wisconsin, where early votes are reported last. They don't begin counting them until Election Day, even though 135,000 more Democrats than Republicans voted early in the Badger state.
And can I just point out how stupid it is that the Republican legislatures in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin made it a law that you can't process those ballots. You can't take them out and verify the signatures
right
before election. You can't even flatten them out, well, so they'll be easier to run through the machine.
And all of that takes extra time. And I think the Republicans in those states
did it on purpose.
They know that. Yeah.
Yeah. They wanted to make it take as long as possible.
Richard goes on to tell me that in Georgia, Iowa, Michigan, and North Carolina, all the ballots will be counted more or less simultaneously. A red mirage will be possible still if the urban Democratic strongholds are the last to finish counting, which is highly likely, he notes, particularly in Atlanta and Detroit. He goes on to tell me what I've been trying to tell you guys for some time, and to not be panicked when it happens. He says, quote, expect Donald Trump to declare victory on election night when he holds the early lead in 6 or 8 of the battleground states. Do not be panicked. Do not be fooled. So with all of that, it is believed unlikely, but we shall see, that a winner is actually going to be called by the media, as Des notes, unofficially on Tuesday night, given how close all of the battleground states are at least believed to be based on pre-election polling. So we may not know for certain on Tuesday night who is the winner of what I have been describing as phase one of the election, essentially everything leading up to the close of polls on Tuesday night, whereas phase two begins immediately thereafter with the tallying of votes and most likely in Trump's case, if he loses, his efforts once again to try to steal the election from the American people as he attempted but failed back in 2020 when he lost to Joe Biden. But there are also likely to be some pretty good clues, I think, as of Tuesday night as to which party is having a better night in general, Republicans or Democrats. But, you know, all 435 seats in the U.S. House were on the ballot on Tuesday in all 50 states, and partisan control of the House, very narrowly held currently by Republicans, is up for grabs this year, as is control of the U.S. Senate, which is currently the majority is very narrowly held by Democrats and believed to be at serious risk in Tuesday's election, short of a huge win for Harris that could somehow sweep with it some surprising flips in Senate races like in Texas or Florida or Nebraska. Partisan control of those chambers, of course, will be very important no matter who is ultimately sworn in as president for many reasons, which I'm quite certain we'll be discussing in the days ahead. There are also thousands of state and local races on the ballot across the country this year, with partisan control of state legislatures up for grabs, about 150 different ballot initiatives of all sorts across the country, including, I believe it's 8 of those initiatives that have to do with abortion rights. Most of those initiatives, all but one, I believe, are about restoring or protecting the right that was ripped away by the corrupted Republican U.S. Supreme Court majority in 2022 and will almost certainly be seen as having a huge effect on the 2024 elections virtually everywhere. Of course, even if the results are generally known on Election Day on Tuesday or the day after, Wednesday, none of those results called by the media or even as conceded or declared as victories by candidates, none of them will be official or verified as correct by anything other than tabulation computers, at least not until several days, sometimes weeks later. And another friendly reminder, a declaration of victory or even a concession by any candidate has actually no official or legal meaning whatsoever. It's a tradition, it's a courtesy, it's a norm, but it has no legal meaning. The only thing that matters are the votes as they are ultimately tallied and certified by state and local officials. And then, in the case of the presidential race, by a joint session of Congress on January 6 next year. But for those who sort of fear a repeat of our last joint session of Congress on January 6, 2021, to certify a presidential election when Trump incited a deadly riot by his supporters to try and stop the certification, well, there have been changes made to the law since then that make a repeat of at least that somewhat less likely. But there are other dates of note in the days ahead in what I am calling phase two of the 2024 election, including the next date of sort of national note for the presidential race. That would be December 11, next month, the so-called and awkwardly named day of the Certificate of Ascertainment of Appointment of Electors. Essentially, that's the date by which, December 11, that all states must, according to federal law, have certified their presidential contest, and in doing so, appoint the slate of electors who will then cast their votes for the state's winner in each state's capital on December 17, as the appointed electors gather to officially cast their vote for the candidate that they have been appointed to vote for. That, as you may recall, was the date back in 2020 when a bunch of slates of fake Republican electors claiming to represent Donald Trump in states that were actually won by Joe Biden, they got together to create fraudulent elector certificates to falsely claim that they were the duly elected electors for their respective states, even though they were not. Now, many of those electors and a number of Trump's team that helped to organize that failed scheme to try to steal 2020, they're currently facing criminal charges for having done so. Some, however, have been tapped as Donald Trump electors once again this year in a number of those states if Trump wins them or if they decide to try and steal it again this year. All of which, in sum, at this point, may be best expressed by satirist Andy Borowitz of the Borowitz Report newsletter last night, which reads as follows. Responding to, quote, a situation of utmost urgency, unquote, President Biden released the nation's strategic alcohol reserve just hours before election night. Immediately following the announcement, the price of vodka dipped below $3 a gallon, and Biden's approval rating surged to 94%. But even as Americans cheered, experts warned that excessive liquor consumption could cause severe mental impairment akin to that exhibited by undecided voters. Statistics show that the nation's alcohol supply has been under acute pressure since November of 2016. Sounds about right. We will, of course, have any and all election results of note on our next thrilling broadcast, and I suspect beyond. Let's take a quick break here. We'll come back with a bit of a history tour with some related stops, a television history tour of a sort, with some related stops in 1958 and 1964. That plus Desi Doyen's latest Green News Report is all still ahead. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is your Bradcast. Cheers.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hopefully it is the last time we ever have to have Donald Trump on our ballots. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. All right, I originally shared this clip way back in January of 2019 after originally coming across it. Actually, after a diarist over at Daily Coast named Azure seemed to have found it and posted it to that site. It was so incredible at the time back in 2019 in the middle of Trump's presidency. It was kind of hard to believe that it was real, but it was fact-checked by the site Snopes. They rang in on it because it was so amazing. I guess they felt like they needed to. It actually is real. And given that I hope to never have the opportunity or need to share this again, I thought it might be sort of fun to do so now as we're waiting for results to come in. Whenever that may happen. So as you noted at the time, this is amazing. In 1958, CBS aired an episode of a show called Trackdown, in which a con man attempted to sell a town a wall in order to protect them from the fake threat of a meteor shower. Is the general premise here beginning to sound familiar yet? So the show's main character, who's played by Robert Culp, ultimately exposes the man to be a fraud who was plotting with the town sheriff to sell this wall in order to enrich himself and then get the hell out of town. It's like an episode from Twilight Zone, except you can't get any weirder or more prescient to our current situation. Again, Snopes.com confirmed the authenticity of this. But it's even more amazing than it sounds as I've described it so far. So you'll see why in a second, if you don't remember from 2019. This was a 30-minute show. It's about 22 minutes without commercial, condensed down here to about 4 minutes as it was originally posted to YouTube back in November of 2016 for some reason. And yes, it really is real, as not done with AI or anything. And yeah, it's amazing, as the character of the con man selling the wall to this town to protect them is actually named, well, here you go, from 1958's Track Down.
I bring you a message. A message few of you will be able to believe. A message of great importance. A message I alone was able to read in the fires of the universe. But be not afraid, my friends. I also bring you the means with which to save yourselves.
Save us from what?
From the end of the world, friend. Which I don't expect you to believe. But the rest of you, those who want to be alive tomorrow morning, I will tell you tonight. Remember that. Bring your friends here. I'll tell you tonight so that you will be able to prepare.
What are you selling, Mr. Snake Oil?
The world will come to a flaming end at midnight tonight. Without my help and knowledge, every one of you will be dead.
Planning to remain in town for long?
Well, I understand I have until midnight. Your name is Trump? All right, Sheriff. How long are you going to put up with this?
What do you mean?
How long are you going to let this con man walk around town?
Be careful, son. I can sue you.
How about it, Sheriff? When are you going to put the lid on?
What for?
Well, stealing is stealing, whether you do it with a gun or a mouthful of mealy words.
I don't intend to sit here and be insulted, Sheriff. If your people don't want my help, I can go elsewhere.
Wait a minute, Mr. Trump. He don't talk for the rest of us.
Since the sheriff wouldn't stop Trump, Hobie had to find somebody who would. Sheriff Chet Farrow was the gun law and helper, and Judge Clement was the book law.
Are you here about Trump?
Yes, sir. What are you going to do about him?
What do you want me to do?
Stop him.
From what?
From taking the town.
Can you prove that that's what he has in mind?
Well, it's obvious.
But can you prove it? In order to arrest him, the sheriff has to have a charge. And Trump hasn't given him a thing to go on.
Well, there's got to be some way to stop him.
Well, if there is, I don't know it. It's a funny thing.
Sir?
When we were kids, we were all afraid of the dark. And we grew up, and we weren't afraid anymore. But it's funny how a big lie can make us all kids again.
Hobie had checked the town. The people were ready to believe. Like sheep, they ran toward the slaughterhouse. And waiting for them was the high priest of fraud.
I am the only one. Trust me. I can build a wall around your homes that nothing will penetrate.
What do we do? How do we save ourselves?
You ask, how do you build that wall? You ask, and I'm here to tell you.
You're a liar, Trump.
There's not going to be any rain of fire.
Can you deny the meteorites will come? Can you deny the comet?
Well, it's not going to happen the way you say it is.
Aren't you going to stay for the fireworks?
Huh? Looks like you're going to go before everything's done.
I've done all I can for Talpa.
Figure it's time for me to be moving on.
Well, I think you ought to wait.
It's where you and I disagree.
You're under arrest, Trump.
What charge?
Well, you write it any way you like. Grand theft, fraud. I think a jury will find it stealing.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
But believable. That was actually real from the 50s Western TV series known as Track Down. That was from 1958. Called The End of the World on CBS. It featured actor Lawrence Dobkin playing the role of Walter Trump, a con man hoping to sell a wall to a town. By the way, he doesn't talk much about that wall anymore, does he?
He certainly doesn't. I wonder why.
Anyway, just wanted to play that one last time. It's funny how a big lie can make us all kids again, as they say in there. Wanted to play it one last time in hopes that I'll never have cause to play it again. But we will see. Finally, sticking with the original golden years of television theme here, and how they apply today, 98-year-old TV legend and icon Dick Van Dyke posted his endorsement of Kamala Harris for president on Monday, adding a video to mark the occasion in which he reads a speech he delivered as written, he notes at the time, by Rod Serling of Twilight Zone fame at a May 31, 1964 civil rights event with Martin Luther King Jr. here in Los Angeles at the LA Memorial Coliseum, preceding the passage of the Civil Rights Act that summer. In the YouTube video, the still remarkably spry 98-year-old entertainer reads those remarks again, focused on how, quote, hatred is not the norm, for which, for some reason, also feels very appropriate today.
Hi, I'm Dick Van Dyke. You may remember I used to sing and dance and fall down a lot, actually. 50 years ago, May 31st, 1964, I was on the podium with Dr. Martin Luther King. He was addressing some of the 60,000 people in the Coliseum in L.A. I was there to read a message written by Rod Serling, the guy who wrote Twilight Zone. I got it out the other day, and I think it means as much today, if not more, than it did then. So if you don't mind, I'd like to read it. Hatred is not the norm. Prejudice is not the norm. Suspicion, dislike, jealousy, scapegoating, none of those are the transcendent facet of the human personality. They're diseases. They are the cancers of the soul. They are the infectious and contagious viruses that have been bleeding humanity for years. And because they have been, and because they are, is it necessary that they shall be? I think not. If there's one voice left to say, welcome to a stranger, if there's but one hand outstretched to say, enter and share, if there's one mind remaining to think a thought of warmth and friendship, then there's a future in which we'll find more than one hand, more than one voice, and more than one mind dedicated to the cause of man's equality. Wishful, hopeful, unassured, problematical, and not to be guaranteed, that's all true. But again, on this spring evening of 1964, a little of man's awareness has shown itself, a little of his essential decency, his basic goodness, his preeminent dignity has been made a matter of record. There'll be moments of violence and expressions of hatred and ugly echo of intolerance, but these are the clinging vestiges of a decayed past, not the harbingers of a better, cleaner future. To those who tell us the inequality of the human animal is a necessary evil, we must respond by simply saying that first, it is evil, but it's not necessary. We prove it sitting here tonight in 1964. We prove it by affirming our faith. We prove it by having faith in our affirmations. Horace Mann said, be ashamed to die unless you won some victory for humanity. I'd like to paraphrase that tonight. Let's be ashamed to live without that victory. 1964. A lot's happened, not so much as Martin Luther dreamed of, but to start. Thank you. God bless.
Thank you, Mr. Van Dyke. Dick Van Dyke, 98 years old, in a video that he posted along with his endorsement of Kamala Harris, as written by Rod Serling and spoken by Dick Van Dyke originally back in 1964 before passage of the Civil Rights Act.
And spoken again in 2024.
As to the harbingers of a better, cleaner future that he mentions, well, take a quick break, and we're back with Green News Report. That's next on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is supporting you and the things that you care about. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. Right now, as much as ever. If you choose to support us, you can do it really easily, safely, and quickly via bradblog.com/donate. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. As noted earlier on today's show, a lot of voters out there facing the wind and the rain in a number of states.
With good cheer and joy. Yeah. It is a nice thing to see.
At least we hope. They seem to be sticking in line, though, which is very good. More related news in our latest Green News Report.
Election day from Wisconsin all the way down the Mississippi River into the Gulf Coast. You need your umbrellas heading out to the polls.
Tornadoes slam Oklahoma as wet weather complicates election day. October 2024 was one of the driest months in U.S. history across nearly every state. Plus,
folks, ports are the linchpin to America's supply chain.
President Biden allocates $3 billion to upgrade and electrify the nation's ports.
All of that electrifying news and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
In parts of the East Coast, it was the warmest Halloween in 50 years, which is why later tonight, I'm going out as a sexy, concerned climate scientist.
Well, they're all sexy and very concerned. This is your Green News Report.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen, before we get to the election and everything else, another storm brewing in the Caribbean?
Yes, indeed. Heads up for the Gulf Coast. Tropical storm Rafael has formed in the Caribbean and is likely to bring more heavy rains and flooding to the lucky people on the central Gulf Coast by this coming weekend.
Yikes. Do we know where on the Gulf Coast yet?
No, but it looks like it might be the New Orleans region, but it's still too early to tell. As we go to air, it's election day with voters across America deciding between two very different futures for their country, their states and communities, and for the world when it comes to combating climate change. But good news, in states recovering from recent extreme weather disasters, voters and election officials are adapting. Even in North Carolina, despite Hurricane Helene's catastrophic destruction, officials say turnout in early voting has surpassed the state's previous record.
Good for North Carolina.
Extreme weather, of course, does not stop for elections. The Oklahoma City metro area was hit Sunday and Monday with a tornado swarm that damaged hundreds of homes and buildings, prompting a state of emergency. More than a dozen injured, but thankfully, no deaths reported.
Shall we assume that the election workers there will be adapting as well?
Well, Oklahoma election officials say the tornadoes won't disrupt their polling places.
That's good.
October in the United States was one of the driest months ever recorded in the lower 48 since record-keeping began in the 1860s. Not the no-alcohol kind of dry October, but the zero-rain kind.
Oh, not as good.
According to the U.S. Drought Monitor, nearly every state in the U.S. is now facing drought conditions, with major cities like New York, Houston, Dallas, Philadelphia, and San Francisco receiving no measurable precipitation for 31 straight days.
Really?
Even parts of the Southeast hit by record rain from hurricanes have dried out.
So my understanding is this is like every state in the Union.
Yeah, except two, Alaska and Kentucky.
Really?
In other news, a new report finds that operatives linked to Russia, China, and Cuba amplified disinformation and misinformation about U.S. government hurricane relief efforts in the aftermath of Hurricanes Helene and Milton, including promoting lies that the U.S. was denying disaster relief claims.
Well, blow me down.
The new analysis from the Institute for Strategic Dialogue found that Russia in particular exploited weak content moderation on U.S.-owned social media platforms such as Twitter or X to sow division before the election.
Of course.
But there is some positive news. European Union emissions dropped a steep 8% last year, faster than expected, thanks to accelerating deployment of renewable energy, battery storage, and electric vehicles.
Wow, that is good news.
Germany last week announced it has cut its use of coal for electricity by 40% over last year.
Also good.
China's carbon emissions fell slightly in 2023, and it has just opened its largest offshore wind project with the capacity of a nuclear power plant. The U.S. is on pace to build nearly 12,000 fast-charging electric vehicle stations this year.
What?
40% more than last year.
Donald Trump told me there was only 9.
And he lies. And a paradigm shift in America, the U.S. electric grid added massive batteries equivalent to 20 nuclear reactors during the Biden-Harris administration.
Really?
And they have already prevented blackouts in multiple states. And finally,
for years I've been saying it's not enough just to rebuild America. We have to build it back better and stronger than before.
President Biden late last week released another round of funding to repair and upgrade the nation's ports. $3 billion in funding from the Inflation Reduction Act to improve and electrify port infrastructure at 55 sites in 27 states and Puerto Rico. The upgrades will generate an estimated 40,000 jobs and will drastically cut emissions and air pollution that impacts workers and local communities.
Cool. For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
And you know how it is, and you're pulling a storm. When you're a long way from home.
Thank you very much, Desi Doyen.
Yes.
Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night, your election day or night with us. It is always greatly appreciated. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. That is made possible by those of you listeners who have been kind enough and generous to hit one of those donate buttons to help us stay on your public airwaves throughout all of this madness. Or you can go straight to bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. Love to hear from you, particularly if you have or saw problems voting or anything else or during the count. I am Bradcast at bradblog.com, and you will find me on the social medias at The Brad Blog. We will see you there until we see you here next time tomorrow with at least some sort of results from Election Day.
We'll see.
We'll see. Buckle up. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.